Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
Julie, you remember those three episodes that we did on maps a while back?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. It was pretty interesting stuff. We talked about the way maps form our view of reality, how maps exist not only on paper but in our minds. We talked about some of the history of cartography, some of the problems entailed within.
Right, and just exploration in general, how map making was this way to, you know, make a concrete idea of the abstract notions of the world around us.
But one area that we didn't really get into that we're going to explore today is the world of monstrosity, particularly the world of sea monsters. Because if you look back on old enough maps, you inevitably encounter fantastic things. You of course, encounter fantastic landforms that deviate to varying degrees from what we know or believe to be the shape of our continents. And then if you go out into the water, you see these strange creatures that don't match up particularly well with anything that actually exists.
And yet, like, these creatures that are represented on these maps, they are really powerful symbols. And we just talked about the power of symbols in a previous episode. So they're stand-ins both for dangers real and imagined.
Yeah. And as it turns out, the whole area of sea monsters is a largely understudied topic, particularly when we're talking about sea monsters on maps. I recently attended a lecture by author Shet Van Duzer, who has put together a fabulous book called Sea Monsters on Medieval and Renaissance Maps, and he thoroughly explored this topic.
True, and I wanted to read a little bit from Ben Shattuck's article from Salon. He talks about why the oceans provide such a rich grounds for imagination. He says there's something about the ocean that keeps on giving to cryptozoology, mostly because it's a great dark room whose door only opens when animals rise to breathe or eat or sun themselves, or when they flash through a cone of light shot from a deep water submersible. There's a bed of sunlight caught in the first 10 feet or so of water, and then total and huge blackness. Still, though, the unsettling sea generates a productive fear to stoke our imaginations.
Ah, that Ben Shattuck. He's good. He's also, of course, the guy who wrote that excellent article about being swallowed alive by a whale.
That's right.
Yeah. So we're talking about monsters, which we've touched on monsters before. I frequently blog about monsters. And as I like to point out, the word monstrosity originates from the Latin monstrere, which means to show or illustrate a point. And in this, as Van Duzer points out, it falls in line with St. Augustine's view of a monster as something that's part of God's plan, an adornment of the universe that can also teach us about the dangers of sin. But then there are other medieval commentators that defined a monster as a thing against nature. So we have to sort of clarify, what are we talking about when we talk about a monster? Because on one hand, a monster is, a fantastic creature that is against the natural order and doesn't actually exist in reality. But then we have things like River Monsters, the Animal Planet show, where these are actually real-world animals, but we refer to them as monsters because they are on some level monstrous.
Yeah, I mean, they defy our expectations, right? Because we have knowledge of our land animals, we have knowledge of ourselves, but when we see these creatures that come from the depths and they are so odd and like us but not like us, well, they become abominations.
Yeah. The popular theory in the medieval ages and on up into the 16th century was this idea that anything that exists on land, there's a version of it that exists in the water. And this goes back to Pliny the Elder's statements in natural history. So the idea here is that you have a stag that lives on the land, well, then there's a sea stag somewhere. There's a lion that lives on the land, well, there's a sea lion. There are men, there are mermen. And literally, it really gets ridiculous when you start looking at the sheer number, because you may think, oh, he's just making some of these up. But just to look in the index of Van Duzer's book, there's reference to a sea bear, a sea bishop, a sea bull, a sea chicken, a sea cow, a sea dog, a sea dragon, a sea elephant, sea frogs, goats, hares, horses, lions, monks, panthers, pigs, pig dogs, pig lions, rabbits, rams, roosters, serpents, stags, tigers, unicorns, and wolves. So you have that idea, that existing sort of philosophic idea of how the world works, and you bring that with you into an actual observation and second and third hand accounts of what is actually going on in the ocean, and you can see where various bits of false data emerge.
Well, and just to confuse things a bit, you have some animals from mythology, like you have, you've got unicorns, but then you've got narwhals, which actually exist. So what do you get, of course? You get some sort of creature that is a unicorn, fish-like creature flailing out there in the ocean.
Exactly. Now, when we talk about these maps, we're talking about these old maps, particularly medieval maps, we're basically talking about two kinds of maps. First of all, there is the Mappa Mundi, a map of the world. And it's really cool. When you look at the simplest and oldest of these, you have what we call a TO map. And I'll include a picture of one of these in the gallery that accompanies this episode. But a TO map, if you'll picture a big circle, all right, that's the world, okay? Imagine a central landmass surrounded by a circular ocean. Now imagine a horizontal line running across it, cutting it in two. That line is the Aegean and Black Sea on the left, and the Nile and the Red Sea on the right. And then a dividing line down the center of that line, forming the stalk of the T, that's the Mediterranean Sea. So this is a vision of the world sort of on its side, where the center of it, the very center of the circle, is Jerusalem, because that's the center of the world, Western Christian tradition. And so the whole northern half of the circle is Asia. Then the lower left-hand quarter is Europe, and the lower right-hand quarter is Africa. Okay?
So this is really a map that is not used to navigate. It's rather a map that's used to record our ideas about the world and how it's configured.
Yeah, we talked about, when we did our map episodes, we talked about, say, something like the map of the tube system in London, about how important it is, certainly to get around London, but also to form an idea in the Londoner's mind of what their city looks like and what their city is. This was a map to make sense of the stories you were hearing about. All right, Jerusalem's so important. Where is it compared to me? Where is Africa compared to me? How do I fit into the world, and what is the shape of the world?
And what's interesting about that is it's got that configuration, the T configuration, which is directly feeding into this idea that we know we have many more neurons that are dedicated to up and down and right and left in terms of our visual field and not diagonal, which is this need to try to put everything into a neat little package.
Yeah. So that's your earliest world map, and they certainly evolve from there up until modern times as we learn more and more about the what the world looks like and how we get from one place to another. So on these maps, on the TO maps, most of the real estate here is concerned with the land. And you'll have some cities marked and some important bits of geography. But as in the 975 Girona Beatus map, sea monsters do appear in the outer ocean, that the outer edge of the circle, the edge of the world. In this particular map from 975, you'll find a marine chicken and perhaps Jonah being swallowed by a whale or having been swallowed by a whale. You see like this big fish and you see Jonah in the belly. Though most of the depictions of Jonah and the whale, it's either Jonah being spit up or mm-hmm. swallowed. Like they tend not to dwell on the whole living inside the belly bit. So that's one type of map. And then you also have nautical charts, because obviously people are sailing from one point to the other, and they need a functional map to tell them how to do that. A TO map is not going to help you really navigate the world. Again, no. It's all about where you are in your head. Where you are actually on a ship at sea, you need a nautical map. And so these would generally have an outline of the land, and they were really only concerned with coastal cities and ports, and they would connect to each other by crisscrossing rum lines. So you could look at this and you'd be like, all right, this is a line you need to follow if you need to get from this port to this port, mm-hmm. from this city to this city. Okay? And the more common variety of these maps was purely utilitarian. There were no frills and there were certainly no sea monsters. But clients could and did opt for specialty add-ons, so you could pay extra for painted cities, for flags, and ultimately sea monsters. And these specialty maps, these were generally not the ones that you would have on the ship. These would be the ones you might give to a king or hanging in your office or whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, medieval maps just didn't have sea monsters depicted on them. Why? Because that's going to cost you more money.
Right.
Right? And it was much more pragmatic at that time, like as you say, from going from point A to point B. But then you see later in the 15th century, as you say, they became a thing. In fact, you mentioned kings. There was a chart maker by the name of Francis Beccari in 1400 who commissioned four really extraordinarily resplendent maps to give to four European kings in exchange for the right to trade in their countries. So mm-hmm. that's how valuable these pieces of paper became, because, again, it represented exploration and also, as well as people could at that time, a compendium of beasts. It was sort of like a learned man's way of trying to learn about the world via the armchair.
Yeah, it becomes a kind of a zoological text as well. Now, I really like the idea of the sea monsters as an add-on. We don't really draw maps for one another anymore, but can you imagine, you're asking a friend how to get to somewhere and you're like, can you draw me a map? Oh, and make sure to put a sea monster on there. I want to have some monsters on that map. Or imagine if when you use Google Maps, you could, in the same way that you have the options to click on the button and have traffic represented, click on the button and have satellite information represented. Mm-hmm. Why is there no monster button? So I can see where sea monsters and land monsters might potentially be represented.
There should be a monster overlay, for sure. But let's talk about some more of these reasons for monsters being depicted. One of the things that I think is really interesting, as we've already touched on, is that the truth is stranger than fiction. Mm-hmm. So you have people who have been out in the oceans fishing for centuries, and they talk about what they have seen. I don't know if they'd see it at the certain depths that it exists, but vampire squid are that's an amazing creature to behold. Sea snakes. Mm-hmm. That seems insane.
Yeah.
And yet they are in the ocean. If you've ever seen a bunch of sea snakes congregating on an ocean floor and floating there like shafts of wheat, just passively feeding on whatever passes by, it is an amazing, incredible image, and you could not believe it. So it stands to reason that if you have this collective of ocean life, mm-hmm. that, of course, these beasts would emerge from all this sort of mythology.
Yeah, and as still happens today, when you encounter you encounter a whale in the ocean, it's pretty phenomenal. Mm-hmm. You encounter a half rotten whale or any kind of partially decayed bit of sea life, you're liable to interpret the original form in a different light.
Mm-hmm.
Even to this day, you'll find pictures of some sort of weird thing washed up on a beach, and people are like, oh my goodness, this looks like nothing on Earth. Clearly it's a sea monster. No, it's just a whale that is grosser and a little decayed. You're seeing more of its skeleton and less of its flesh, and therefore it looks like a sleeker, different creature.
That's true. And even now things are getting reclassified, right? Because every once in a while we find the bones of something and say, oh, we think that this is a new something. And they're like, no, 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 this is actually a Brachiosaurus.
Yeah. Now, again, as we mentioned, sea monsters, a lot of them are going to originate in myth and religious tradition. You have Jonah's whale, you have the primordial Leviathan. One of the stories that keeps coming up again and again in Van Duzer's book is the idea of the whale or fish that's so enormous that a ship lands at it. And then the sailors get off on what they think is land. They they camp, they set a fire, and then when they set the fire, that disturbs the fish, and the fish descends back into the ocean, and they have to scramble to get back on the ship before they drown. Now, clearly, this never happened, or it's at least very difficult to imagine a scenario in which this could happen. But it becomes such a tale, like it captures the imagination, and so it comes up again and again on these maps.
It's true. And, you know, their representation on the maps is not just a symbolic stand-in for man versus nature, but is also a way to depict actual geographical points of interest or even dangerous straits on a map. So there's actual pragmatic reason for them to be on there.
But a lot of these cartographers, though, what they were trying to do is they were trying to utilize the best information of the time to create a map that it's either going to stand on its own or it's accompanying some other text. And so most of the time they'd never seen these creatures before, but they were laboring to create accurate depictions. In many cases, they continued existing motifs, such as the island fish, and presumed factual depictions of actual life in the oceans. The hybrids that they ended up drawing, well, those were backed up in the theory of this land-water duality that we mentioned earlier. And they were able to repeat the true aspects of their depictions. Whales are big, they spout water, and sometimes they damage boats, as well as the inaccuracies. Whales have two blowholes. They have wolfish faces, and they attack boats.
Yeah, it's cool, because I think about these maps as sort of the graphic novel of the time. Trying to record as much scientific information as thought scientific at that time, and trying to explain the creatures. But the problem is that you don't get a lot of clear perception of these creatures that you see without context.
Yeah, a lot of times these are again people who are several times removed from any actual observation of the creature. You have in the same way that Umberto Eco said that books speak to other books, and there's this endless conversation, particularly between older manuscripts, where this idea flows to this one and is picked up by this one. It's like that game we all play as a kid where you whisper in a circle.
And what telephone?
Yeah, telephone. It's like a game of telephone with text and then with visual representations of the world.
You're right. And at the end of that telephone conversation, you get the Vaca Marina, the sea cow, right?
Yeah.
Because everything gets so distorted. I was thinking about the perception and context problem in terms of Ben Shattuck's article for Salon, in which he was trying to pin down a 19th century account of a massive sea serpent. The fisherman had described it as 100 feet long with an interlocking barrel-like body and a serpent-like face. And he kind of kept scratching at this, saying, "What? I mean, these are like hardened fishermen. They're all like, you know, they've been out there, they're experienced, and yet there's so many of these fishermen who said, we saw something," and he wonders, what could it be? So he talks to someone who is an expert in leatherback turtles. Her name is Kara Dodge, and she says that, you know, it's probably just that perception problem, because she says that even when trying to track leatherback turtles now, they have to train fishermen to look for the hump and not the fin. And so now they're getting a ton more accounts of leatherback turtles as they try to pin their whereabouts. Until you give people the context for it or the imagery, then it's hard to pin down. By the way, the whole leatherback turtle thing, sea serpent, turns out, Ben Shattuck thinks from his research, that it could have just been essentially a bunch of leatherback turtles that were bumped up against each other.
Oh, okay. And it makes the appearance of these humps of serpent.
Yeah, because you're saying if you look at videos of leatherbacks, it's kind of the slimy black image that emerges from just under the water. And then if you look at their faces, they're serpent-like and they have fangs.
Huh.
So if you saw that from a good distance away, you might think that it's this 100-foot sea serpent coming at you. Now, the other thing about that is that narrative might serve you well if you decide to make a map to dissuade other fishermen from coming to your country and fishing your waters. And that's where I think it's fascinating that a map from the 16th century could have an economic function built into it.
Yeah, the map in question is Olaus Magnus's amazing 1539 map, the Carta Marina, which I'll make sure to include this one in the gallery that goes with this episode as well, because it's really the granddaddy of these. I mean, it's a marvelous map from a number of different perspectives. He brings whimsy to his creations of the monsters. Mm-hmm. He brings an artistry. And just a sheer number of monsters on this map is incredible. The world is just completely monster haunted, and it's beautiful. But there is this theory that that he used a lot of these monsters to scare away foreign fishermen from Scandinavian waters.
Right, because if you were to look at this map, you'd be like, ho, yeah. Forget it. There's this dragon sea serpent thing at every turn, or this other lobster/octopus thing that might take me down.
Yeah, and the full map included like a zoological sidebar that explained like what some of these creatures were supposed to be. And yeah, you look at it and there are just all sorts of fantastic whales and whale-like creatures spouting up. They're attacking ships. They're pulling ships down. They're flooding them with their spouted water. It's marvelous.
Well, one of my favorite ones on there is that lobster looking like creature that's said to be an octopus, and it's depicted with eight legs and it's holding a man in one of its claws.
Yes.
And scale, you can see that it's monstrous in comparison to this man. And according to its scientific information, it lives in underwater caves and can change its color to match its surrounding. Now, that's amazing, right? Because
yeah.
What we're hearing there is that there's some cephalopod information, right?
Yeah. At the core of this, we have some good information. Eight limbs, can change its color, lives in the rocks underwater.
Yeah, we're talking about this perception of chromatophores, right?
Yeah.
Well, at the time, they weren't called chromatophores, but this idea that cephalopods can change their skin color mm-hmm. through pigment cells. So think about being on a ship at night and gazing over the prow and seeing bioluminescent light then emanating from a squid, and that's from the bacteria that's being housed in the organ lights. And just what a sight that
yeah.
would be, that there's this monstrous creature below that has a beacon of light coming from it.
Yeah, we throw in the narrative of monstrous creatures in the ocean, and that makes the thing ginormous. And then if you have somebody attempting to create it on a map, and you know, how would you come up with the idea of the octopus if you had never seen one? You know, like clearly this the artist had some experience with crustaceans, and so that is the form that the artistic representation of the creature took.
Yeah, it's amazing, because you see
yeah.
the good bits of science in there mixed in with fantastical.
It's in a way, it's kind of like all of our depictions, or a lot of our depictions of alien life. There's something humanoid or vaguely humanoid about them. You know, that is the form that we understand as intelligent life, so that's the form we tend to project in trying to understand mythical or imagined creatures. And it's similar here. The form that they understood was the crustacean, so that's the one that was projected.
Are you saying that we just need to be retrained to look for humps instead of fins out there?
No, I mean, I
in the intergalactic space?
I think it just comes down to the fact that you have data in your mind that you're using to understand the outer world,
mm-hmm.
and we're never going to have enough data to understand some of the mysteries out there. We're going to be able to sort of partially construct them.
Which has implications for how we perceive our universe, right?
Yeah. All right, well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to run through some more specific examples of how we have interpreted real things as fantastic sea monsters and the sort of journey from pure myth to truth in the walrus and in the whale. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
All right, we're back. And first of all, let's talk a little bit about the walrus. Now, the walrus is a great example of a creature that that does not exist worldwide. It's not something that you would have, it's not a form you would have common knowledge of. You know, like a fish, you know, fish vary a lot, but they're sort of a prototypical fish. And you can, you know, one culture knows what a fish is, another culture knows what a fish is. A walrus is a little more exotic. It's a little more monstrous. So when we look to the various interpretations of the walrus on these maps, again, often depicted by someone several times removed from actual observation of the thing itself, mm-hmm. you see a curious evolution of form. And there's an excellent bit in Van Duzer's book where he lays out eight different images and you get to see how it changes. For instance, you look at the 1516 Carta Marina by Martin Waldseemüller, and you'll see what looks like a deformed elephant. Then you look at a 1522 copy of Ptolemy's Geography, and this time the same artist, Waldseemüller, depicts a straight-up elephant. Like, the first time it was kind of a monstrous elephant, and then he's just like, oh, it's an elephant. Like, it has feet, it has the tusk.
It does.
It's just a brown elephant that apparently lives in the water and is a walrus. Okay? Fast forward to 1539-ish, our man, Oleg Magnus, depicts something that looks more like a fishy alligator with tusks. It has kind of that wolfish face common to many sea monster depictions. And this design pops up in other cartographers' work as well. But then we look at 1555, 1558, 1595, and we see depictions of the walrus continue to grow more and more accurate. A rounder head, flippers instead of feet, tusks like a walrus instead of an elephant, and they begin to take on a more appropriate color. So in this, we see what begins as just an attempt to understand an exotic form mm-hmm. by using what you knew.
Mm-hmm.
You knew what an elephant looked like from existing, well-maintained and well-backed-up illustrations. And so you apply that form to imagining this tusked, fat creature that lives in Arctic waters.
You know, the weird thing about that is when you consider extreme mammals that have gone extinct and you turn back the clock, you start to see some of these weird attributes showing up. And I'm thinking about the whale with legs.
Yes.
That was in the exhibit Extreme Animals here at Fernbank. And how that sort of plays into this idea of this walrus that's depicted here in the book.
Now, it should be noted, even though a lot of these cartographers were, again, trying to use the best information of the time to depict an accurate vision of the world, there was still a lot of uncritical copying of sea monsters. For instance, a 1558 edition of Cornelius Anthosi's Carta van Usselot, a map of northern Europe, it included a fabulous flying turtle. It's kind of like a gamma creature in a way. It's got like this kind of beaked nose. It's got mostly a turtle body around the rest of it, except its front legs are like eagle wings. So it's a really fabulous looking creature. But here's the thing. It turns out it was probably the logo of the publisher. And that's the only reason it was on the map. The publisher's logo was this flying turtle.
Right.
And then when people copied that map, they included it as if it was supposed to be there, as if it was a depiction of the natural world. It would be like if you copied a Rand McNally map
mm-hmm.
and you included that Rand McNally diamond logo and said it was a continent. You know?
Right. Yeah, I can't help but thinking, I'm sorry, a little bit distracted by the Legos Chimera sets that have come out. Have you seen those?
Of a chimera?
The Chimera Lego sets where they've got different animals depicted.
No, I haven't seen those.
They should take a page from these maps, I'm telling you.
But that's not to say that, again, that everybody was just copying monsters willy-nilly. There were definitely some skeptics of the time, and that's always important when you're talking about the Middle Ages or Renaissance times, that not everybody was just blindly believing everything that came across their plate. One great example of this, as explained in Van Duzer's book, you had this guy, Fra Mauro. Fra Mauro lived in 1450 thereabouts when he was doing his thing, and he wrote, "Because there are many cosmographers and most learned men who write that in this Africa there are human and animal monsters, I think it is necessary to give my opinion. In all these kingdoms of the Negroes, I have never found anyone who could give me information on what those men have written. Thus, not knowing anything, I cannot bear witness to anything, and I leave research in the matter to those who are curious about such things." So basically he's saying, I'm not buying this information that you're telling me about what's going on in Africa in terms of the strange creatures and the weird people that live there, so I'm not going to comment on it, I'm not going to draw it, etc.
And yet, it's a little bit of a weak sauce statement, because it's like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
I suppose that was bold for back then, though.
Yeah, yeah.
So, let's talk about whales, because these guys are amazing in terms of the sort of stories that were circulated around about them, and then how it was depicted and the images of them. And I was thinking about this because last night I was looking at pictures of humpback whales.
Yes.
And I was looking at their blowholes.
As you do. Yeah,
as I
yeah.
do. And I couldn't help but just be really sort of taken back, because as I looked at those pictures, it started to look like a giant human snout stuck on the back of a whale. And if you look at pictures close up of the blowhole, you'll see that there's like a little bridge between what looks like nostrils.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, if that were to be swimming, parallel to your ship, and you happen to look at that, wouldn't you sort of misunderstand that as a distortion or, as a sort of monstrosity of a human form in a way that it looked like, oh, this must be a monster because there's their giant snout. And how then would that be depicted?
Yeah, how would you describe that to somebody and they had to draw it having not seen it, and you weren't there to say, no, a little more, a little closer to the animal's back. No, a little more like a human nose. You know, if you weren't there to actually get that kind of feedback,
mm-hmm.
how would they draw it? So,
and if, yeah, water is just spouting out of it, right?
Yeah.
Then it's sort of like, well, what do you mean water spouts out of it? Then clearly there must be some sort of tube system here.
Yeah. So it, as we've mentioned previously, the whale is a pretty classic sea monster. People have been seeing them for ages. Even before we knew what to call it, we had the Leviathan, we had the giant fish that swallowed Jonah, you had the island fish that we talked about where the people land on it. In many of the older whales of the 1500s especially, they were these wolf-faced beasts with long fish tails. They were spouters, but it took a while to work out exactly what all that spouting was about. For instance, you look at one map from 1583, you see this very wolfish, actually furry sea monster, known as a spouter, attacking a ship, by vomiting water upon its deck, out of its mouth. So mm-hmm. here's a great example of someone probably said, oh, well, there are these whales, and they spout water, they spit up water. And so then the artist's depiction of that is a whale rolling up to the ship, opening its mouth, and just vomiting water on it, and just completely drowning the ship.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's that. And then if you look at Oleg Magnus's Carta Marina again, you see that the whales here spout water from two blowholes, two Shrek-like, tube-like horns that emerge from the top of the creature. And this is a classic attribute of Magnus's maps and his depictions of sea monsters. And the crazy thing is that it matches up so well with what you were just saying about the humpback whale's real blowholes. If someone were to say, oh, well, they have these two holes on their back and they mm-hmm. spit water. And then if it's passing through, you know, down the telephone game of illustration and manuscript and map making, and that comes to somebody and they're like, okay, well, what does an animal like that look like if it has two holes on its back to spit water out of? And then it becomes this idea of these two tubes sticking out of the creature's back.
Right, and you can kind of see, again, like how this this weirdness occurs in the depictions. In fact, it's very steampunk-looking, a lot of these.
Yeah, there's a certain... You can't help but interpret them as kind of smokestacks, so they have this kind of biomechanical vibe to them.
Yeah. Now, I can't help but be reminded of this class that I took in college, and it was a psychology class having to do with sexuality, and one of the things we had to do is we had to pair up, and one of us had to look at a depiction of a sexual act, and the other person had to draw it as described by the person looking at it.
Okay.
So one of the things I remember is there was a Victorian woman on a bike that was made of a penis. Let's just say that. Penis parts.
Okay.
Which is kind of a difficult thing to try to... I mean, everybody knows what a bike is, but then you have to describe a bike that's made out of a penis.
Yeah, it seemed like it'd be difficult to make them out of penises.
Well, you know, yeah. This was out of someone's imagination, and so the other person had to try to describe what they were looking at. Well, you could go across the class, and you could see all sorts of variations of what this penis bike looked like, and it made me think, well, this is very much the same thing that's going on in these depictions of maps, minus the penis.
Yeah.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Another great example of this comes from Pierre Dessalier's world map of 1546, which has a fairly realistic depiction of whalers harpooning a whale. But it's a little serpentine, its flippers are a bit like wings, and most remarkably of all, it has a gigantic mustache. It looks kind of like the luck dragons from the Neverending Story.
It's a gentleman whale.
Yeah. So why does the whale have the mustache? Why is there suddenly, because they're trying to, clearly it's an attempt to depiction of an actual cultural tradition of whaling, of hunting the whales, catching the whales, harvesting the whales. And a lot of these accounts included, some very specific accounts of what then the whale parts are used for and how it's used, culturally and economically. But it has this mustache. Well, according to Van Duzer, the mustache is probably the artist's attempt to portray baleen, which the whaling Basques commonly referred to as barbas de balena, or the beards of the whale. So, again, you have this, you're trying to make the best use of the information that's provided to you, and then someone talks about the beard of the whale.
Are you talking about the filtering system of the baleen whale?
Yeah, the baleen, which, of course, is very internal, and is certainly not a mustache.
Right.
But if you describe it as the beards of the whale, and then someone down the chain has to draw the beards of the whale, this is what you get, a whale with a giant mustache.
I love it. I just like to imagine them sitting around. At some pub saying, it's like when you get, the crumbs in your mustache.
Yeah.
And it filters it out.
And it's easy for us as modern commentators to have a lot of fun with this. But just think about how today, like, all the information in the world is instantly at your fingertips.
Mm-hmm.
If you even halfway know what you're doing on the internet, you can fact check something pretty quickly. But still think of the emails you get in your inbox just spouting complete nonsense that no one, or the questions that come up on Facebook where you're like, really, why are you asking all of us when you could have just Googled that and found out immediately if you knew what sources to look for? Now, I'll take that same mindset or even some variation of it and put it in an age without internet where you only have books speaking to books over the course of decades and centuries.
And this is the kind of closed system of information that you get.
Exactly. Now, that's not to say we didn't have accurate depictions of whales, though. As early as 1413, we see a realistic illustration of a whale hunted by whalers on Mercier de Velasti's nautical chart. And finally, in an interesting closure of these two trends of the fantastic and the realistic, we see the Nova Francia map, which features an old-fashioned sea monster with double spouts and wolfish heads, very much in Magnus's style. But then you also see an incredibly realistic portrayal of whalers harvesting a whale. So you see the incorporation of the older idea of the sea monster as just a fantastic decorative note, while you also see this very accurate depiction of whales and whaling.
Mm-hmm.
So you see the two coming together. And you see the idea of the old sea monster becoming more and more just a relic, more and more just a decoration that eventually fades away.
Well, or it becomes a tattoo, right? Because it still has power as a symbol.
Yeah, because you found that awesome tattoo where someone had one of Oleg Magnus's Shrek horn sea monsters.
And even some of the more classical tattoos that show all sorts of sea creatures, taking down a boat or just being ferocious. It kind of is this sort of talisman against your trade if you are someone who is, a marine merchant or just who works in the industry. Industry being in, of the ocean.
The ocean industry. Yeah. So in a sense, you can look at sea monsters on maps as a story of man versus ocean over the course of centuries. We see the gradual journey from the ocean as a place of chaos and certain death to a thing conquered by man. Think back to those early depictions in the OT world maps, where again, the outer ocean is teeming with monsters. Or as in a Mapamundi from 1180, most of the map is outer ocean as a tail-eating serpent. Or Ouroboros. And then you also see various Titan-sized sea monsters out there as well. But we gradually learn to combat the ocean, and we gradually learn to combat these monsters of the mind. In the Gulf of Catalan Atlas of 1375, we see a depiction of pearl divers utilizing spells to keep sea monsters at bay. 1545, there's a map where we see men aboard a ship driving spears into an attacking beaked tentacled horror. And in the Carta Marina, we see men blowing trumpets to ward off one of these spouting whales. And then, most remarkably, 1516, on Martin Waldseemüller's Carta Marina, we see King Manuel of Portugal riding a sea monster off the tip of Africa to symbolize Portugal's mastery of the oceans. And from there, again, sea monsters become more and more decoration, and we start adding more and more ships into our artistic representation of the ocean,
And more technology. Yeah. And they kind of go by the wayside because by the time the camera has been invented and is starting to document nature, then you have a moving away of this idea of these really monstrous creatures.
Yeah. And then the maps begin to rot. We only retained a very slim number of them. And they just become creatures of fantasy. And then we tend to forget that at times they were wrapped up in symbolism, that they had economic purpose, that they were attempts to understand the zoology of the ocean.
Yeah, and I wanted to kind of lead out of this episode with a passage that Shattuck actually brings up in his article. It's from Moby Dick, and it's when Ishmael climbs up the rigging to take his watch. And he's sitting on the topsail yard, and his leg is kind of hanging lazily over by the sail, and he's reflecting on all the other young men who have taken watch from those heights. And here it is. It says, "Lulled in such an opium-like listlessness, a vacant, unconscious reverie, is this absent-minded youth by the blending cadence of waves and thoughts, that at last he loses his identity, takes the mystic ocean at his feet for the visible image of that deep, blue, bottomless soul pervading mankind and nature, and every strange, half-seen, gliding, beautiful thing that eludes him, every dimly discovered, uprising fin of some indiscernible form, seems to him the embodiment of those elusive thoughts that only people the soul by continually flitting through it."
There you go. Yeah.
Man and nature as one.
Awesome. Well, on that note, let's call the robot over and let's see if we have any listener mail. All right, we have one for you today. This one is from Aaron. Aaron writes in and says, "Hi, Robert and Julie. I was just listening to the Circus Freaks episode, and it brought me back to my college days. My nursing school was part of a university with a music theater school." It's a great combination. You bring those two energies together. One day, those worlds collided. A visiting pyrotechnic stage professional came to a small gathering my friends were having. We learned to swallow fire. The trick was using kerosene, like you mentioned, in the fire blowing. It's not toxic, and it burns just warmer than the human mouth. I won't give the particulars, but it was an amazing trick I haven't done since. My husband shakes his head in shame when I tell people I can do this, and my father-in-law wants me to do this at his Viking funeral. We're thinking cremated ashes in a small wooden boat in a small pond, casting the whole thing into a ball of fury with flaming arrows. Thank you so much for your mind-blowing podcast. I am embarking on a new career. I listen to your podcast while baking tasty muffins for a farmer's market here in town with the hopes of expanding to a small cafe. Your podcast, as well as your siblings on the Stuff Network, gives me hours of entertainment while baking and boxing my goods. I've also started having a quiz for my Facebook followers using the knowledge I've gained. Again, thanks sincerely, Aaron, the Main Street Muffin Factory."
All right. Well, that was very entertaining. A Viking funeral.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a way to go out.
That's a good way to go out on an episode about sea monsters, too.
Indeed.
Yeah. So, hey, would you like to learn more? Would you like to see more? Again, head by stufftoblowyourmind.com. After you listen to this one, you're listening, whichever, find the gallery that we've put together with pictures of some of these monsters we've talking about. I'll definitely be including a lot of stuff from Olga Magnus's fantastic map, and you can look at those all you want and pull up a big screen version of the map as well if you want to just really pore over it. And you can also let us know what you think about all this. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Tumblr. You can find us on Twitter. On Twitter, we are Below the Mind. And we'd love to hear from you about your thoughts on sea monsters. If you've looked at them a lot, what are some of your favorites? What are some of your favorite real-life monsters in the ocean?
Do you have a sea monster tattoo?
Yes, if you have a sea monster tattoo, we would love to see it if it is appropriate for us to see it.
You can also check us out on Stuff to Blow Your Mind on YouTube, where we look at the camera and commit acts of word salad.
Yeah, Mind Stuff Show.
Mind Stuff Show. And you can also drop us a line at blowthemind@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cb for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
We are the voice of NASCAR.
The green flag is in the air, and we are underway. The Great American Race.
The Motor Racing Network. NASCAR Cup, Xfinity, and Craftsman Truck Series Racing. Live on your hometown radio station and MRN or NASCAR.com. Martinsville, Talladega, the Chicago Street Course. We have the side-by-side action and last lap passes for the win.
Photo finishes. Ryan Blaney will win.
The voice of NASCAR, the Motor Racing Network.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.